Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Corn growers have planted at least 96% of their crop. Soybean producers not far behind, 94% of the crop in the ground. And in fact, because of weeks of pretty open weather.
Every single state running ahead of their planting five-year average pace.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says also every state's crop is ahead of average on emergence as well. USDA has put out now its first look at soybean condition, showing 62% of the crop in good to excellent condition. Nationally, 7% poor to very poor. Not too bad, but...
with a little bit of early trouble in states like Michigan, 21% very poor to poor. Missouri at 14%, Nebraska at 10%.
Rippey says we're going to have to watch the dryness that's continuing.
We need rain in just about all corners of the Midwest.
Gary Crawford, Washington.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The Port of Los Angeles is the nation's busiest port, processing $440 billion in cargo value every year. But there are concerns because workers don't have a contract. How will it affect trade?
U.S. ag exports are forecast at $181 billion for fiscal year 2023, down $3.5 billion from expectations in the February forecast. Veronica Nye, senior economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, says the U.S. is facing a significant trade imbalance.
Relative to last year, USDA is now projecting that U.S. ag exports will be down $15 billion, while imports are projected up $4 billion. That means the trade balance is estimated to be at a deficit of $17 billion. When we think about that in a volume versus value basis, exports are expected down 19% by volume and 16% by value relative to last year.
Nye says U.S. ag trade is being impacted by global monetary conditions.
Well, for anyone who's buying anything, it won't be a surprise that inflation remains on a slowing trend, but economic growth challenges are materializing as monetary conditions tighten. World real GDP is projected to increase by only 2.8% in 2023. That's down from 3.4% last year.
She says the impact of these economic challenges vary by commodity.
When you look on the corn side, exports are expected down 26% by value, 27% by volume. Sorghum is down over two-thirds by value, 68% by volume, 69%. Now, it's not all bad news. Beans are expected down on volume by 7%, but only down by 3% on value. And then when we move to the meat case, beef exports are expected down 14%, but pork exports are expected up, as are broiler meat exports. So certainly a mixed bag.
Michael Clements, Washington.
And volatility is not what the hog markets need. Chad Smith reports.
Market volatility is hitting livestock producers while their input costs have climbed. Bernd Nelson, an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, says prices were much higher last year before dropping off in the first quarter of 2023.
Input costs, demand, and supply really combined to give us a different situation here. Profitability started to deplete when we saw prices dropping in hogs. Prices really rallied high last year. In fact, we saw some record cash offerings put out for hogs. Now, as we look forward in 2023, especially for the first quarter, prices really dropped off. Input costs, feeds, labor, infrastructure, things of that nature have stayed really high comparatively. And so profitability really fell out of the hog market for the first quarter.
He says the hog market can change dramatically, and we've already seen big shifts take place.
We looked at markets Tuesday. We saw a limit up move in lean hog, especially in July futures. Really, on the drop of a dime, we went through a very bearish market situation to a very bullish market situation. Cash traded a lot higher, not just a little higher, dramatically higher. The national average hog price was up $11.50, and it's expected to continue follow through.
Nelson said he's expecting prices to move higher in the months ahead thanks to a few key factors.
The global pork supply is much tighter, and demand from other countries like China is starting to pick up. All the meat supplies are getting tighter globally. We have avian influenza affecting the poultry industry. We have tighter supplies in beef from the ongoing drought scenarios and high input costs. And we're still seeing some drought linger on, especially in the Corn Belt region. And tighter global supplies in the pork market due to African swine fever and declining overall inventories.
Chad Smith, Washington.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Senator Cornyn, Grassley, myself, Durbin, all of us have been seeking a solution to a vexing problem for years. So let's start with the idea that it is a problem.
At a recent Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on farm and immigrant workers, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina.
I'm surprised that only 60% of the people working in agriculture are immigrants. I thought it'd actually be more. So what we have is a dilemma. Nobody on this committee wants to deny an American worker a job in any area of the economy. You can't get an H-2A visa until you try to hire an American to do the job in question. And legal immigration, as you well know, Mr. Chairman, is designed to help American companies who fall short in hiring here at home so they can have a robust workforce, add it to the native-born workforce or the U.S. citizen workforce to keep the company in America so they don't have to leave. And, you know, the visa programs supplement the American citizen workforce to give the employer a chance to stay in business here at home. So it's a win-win.
There's a problem for filling that farm labor and worker shortage.
The problem is, you've identified, is it's very difficult for employers right now to find workers in certain areas of our economy. I am here to tell you that H-2A, H-2B, we're not denying an American worker a job. We're creating an opportunity for an American employer to stay in business in America. The problem we have, Mr. Chairman, is if we legalize the agricultural workforce, give legal status without securing our border and changing our asylum laws first, you'll have a run on this country that you've never seen. It will be pouring gasoline on a fire. That's the dilemma. I am not antagonistic to trying to find a solution to the agricultural dilemma of creating a more robust legal system so you can access legal workers and some can stay because they would add value to our country. But if we legalize everybody here in the agricultural sector without first securing our border and changing the magnets that are drawing 6 million people in the last couple of years to our country, then we'll have made the problem worse. So I just would end on this note. Very sympathetic to the dilemma faced by the immigrant workforce and by the employers, but the solution of legalizing millions of people in the agricultural community without first dealing with the broken border and a broken asylum system, I think, is ill-conceived.
Chairman of the committee is Dick Durbin from Illinois. He says solutions exist.
Senator Graham, I don't disagree with you, but I think there is an orderly way to do this. In the bills that have been prepared by Senator Bennett, for one, our friend who was on the Gang of Eight, really put a time requirement in this so that the workers had to be here for, I think it was 20 years under one of our proposals. So this is not going to be a run on the border in any respect. You have to shown that you're a reliable worker, number one, and a trustworthy future American over a long period of time to qualify. And I would also say I am all for an orderly process at the border. I think we all agree on that. If we establish an H-2B process or something like it that has specific numbers coming in who are monitored while they're here in the United States, I think it's going to avoid the calamitous outcome that you think may happen. I hope I'm right.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This I-40 North corridor has really been pretty covered up the last 10 days or so.
Andy Gratz is with Alta Seeds in the Texas Panhandle.
A lot of guys are struggling, running up against the cotton deadline and trying to get stuff insured and put in the ground. Moisture kind of put us on a setback on that plan, and a lot of producers are having to make some tough choices and go to plan B at this point. You know, south of the I-40 area, it's hit or miss. Some areas have gotten significant rainfall, well deserved, well needed at this point. But and you really hate to complain and shut this thing off. We really need it all year to even have a chance to get somewhat caught up after coming out of the last 3 years and the drought problems we've had.
So what are producers in that region looking at now?
You know, herbicide packages and whatnot on these burn down programs. With the rain, obviously, is going to come some weed pressure stuff that we haven't seen in the last few years due to the drought. That and expectations, I mean, kind of aligning what we're, our end goal is in our input wise, where are we sitting there and getting the whole thing bundled together to where it kind of makes sense to switch that option at this point. The other thing too, coming out of this drought that I've seen a lot of these producers, you know, understanding that the feed needs for these cattle producing guys, is very, very high coming out of those drought years. So we're going to have a lot of guys looking at that option of making hay or even, cutting silage, and had a lot of questions on that lately. These big dairy and commercial feedlots are looking, typically wanting to have a year's feed on the slab, and coming out of that drought, there just isn't that amount of feed. And so I think we're up against the need on that as well. So I've had a lot of questions on the forages and sorghum side of it, and options there as far as what can we get in here with and produce some tonnage and, you know, help these cattle producers out tremendously. So there is some options, I think, left on the table, Tony, with even whether it's a grain sorghum or a forage side of it, some options that these guys are definitely weighing and seeing where their needs are and what we can get done.
A major challenge in growing more acres of sorghum has been a little pest known as the sugarcane aphid.
Many of my hybrids are going to be tied to what we call the aphix lineup, meaning it's an aphid-tolerant product. Alta takes a very big pride in testing these products, and once we slap that label on these products, we are confident in them performing under those situations. It's just another problem that we face, especially with the rain situation we've got going on. You know, moisture comes, and it just kind of compounds some other issues, and aphid being one of them. I think we see a higher influx and higher population of those problems. But, you know, we're confident in our lineup in saying that it's going to handle that aphid pressure, and we have many, many options to go down that path to where we can get some good stands and not really have a problem with those bugs that are going to be with it.
Another issue that sorghum growers across the South have dealt with in the past, standability.
We sell a lot of seed down on the coast as well, all the way up through Texas, and that's been a hot topic as far as standability and these guys not wanting to have to go in there and figure out how to pick it up off the ground. And we've prided ourselves. These hybrids are structured to do that. And, you know, tough times, bad times, drought tolerance. I mean, we've really prided ourselves on standability and making sure that these products are going to be there for that grower when they do go in to get it. And really, the portfolio, like I said, is very well rounded to adapt. And really, these acres change so drastically, even from Lubbock to Amarillo, just in that short time frame, type of soils and water conditions and pH issues. And we really have adaptability with many key products to where we can fit either any acre.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You can see signs of trouble starting to percolate.
Brad Rippey, meteorologist at USDA, on signs of problems for the corn crop.
As you look at the Midwest, we've got Missouri leading the region with 16% of the corn rated very poor to poor. Very dry through some of that northern and central Missouri production area. And that 16% is up from 14% a week ago. Even more dramatic in Pennsylvania. Granted, it's outside the heart of the Corn Belt, but it's kind of a warning sign there in the east. And things are very, very dry. 20% of Pennsylvania's corn currently rated very poor to poor, up from 4% a week ago. Other states with double-digit very poor to poor ratings on June 4th, Illinois at 11% and Kansas at 10%.
And this is leading to a lack of optimism among farmers. Dr. Jim Mennert is director of the Center for Commercial Ag.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index declined sharply this month. It was down 19 points compared to last month. That leaves the index 5 points higher than it was a year earlier, but it is 54 points below where it was 2 years ago. The index of current conditions and the index of future expectations were both down this month. Current conditions were down 13 points compared to a month earlier, but that leaves it still 20 points higher than it was a year ago. The future expectation index was down 22 points compared to last month. That's 3 points lower than it was a year ago. The Farm Financial Performance Index was also down this month. It was down 17 points compared to a month earlier when the reading was 93. The index is now 5 points below where it was a year ago and 50 points below where it was 2 years ago. The Farm Capital Investment Index was also down. It was down 6 points compared to last month, but that leaves an index up just 2 points compared to what it was a year ago. The index is now 28 points below where it was 2 years ago. When we followed up with producers who said now is a bad time to make large investments in the farming operation, two-thirds of them cited rising interest rates and the increased prices for farm machinery and new construction as the primary reasons why they think it's a bad time to make new investments. For the fourth month in a row, we asked producers what they expect to see happen with respect to prime interest rates here in the U.S. Compared to prior surveys, more producers say they expect no change in interest rates, but 59% of producers still think interest rates are going to rise over the next year. And in a related question, 40% of respondents expect this spring's bank failures to lead to some changes in farm loan terms in the upcoming year. Farmers' short-term outlook for farmland values declined this month. The short-term farmland value expectation index declined to a reading of 110 compared to 123 last month, and that's 25 points lower than it was a year ago. The longer-term index, however, actually rose a little bit. It was up 3 points compared to April. That leaves that index down 4 points compared to where it was 1 year ago. Looking more closely at farmers' short-term outlook for farmland values, the percentage of producers expecting farmland values to decline actually rose from 14% last month to 19% this month, and the percentage expecting values to actually increase declined from 37% to 29% this month. For the second month in a row, we asked producers what they think the likelihood is of Congress passing a new farm bill in 2023. This month, just 33% of the producers think it is at least somewhat likely the farm bill will be passed by the end of the year. That's down from 40% that felt that way last month. When we asked producers what the most important title is in a new farm bill, 48% chose crop insurance, followed by commodity programs chosen by 25% of the producers in this month's survey. In a follow-up farm bill question, we asked corn and soybean producers whether they expect to see PLC reference prices for corn and soybeans to remain unchanged, increased, or actually reduced. 45% of the producers in this month's survey said that they expect to see PLC reference prices raised in the upcoming farm bill.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
For more than three decades, Congress has failed to modernize our nation's immigration system.
Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, looking into farm labor.
As a result, our nation's farms, factories, and food processing facilities have struggled to secure a steady, stable, and supply of workers. I work with my friend, the ranking member, Senator Graham, and others on both sides of the aisle to advance bipartisan legislation to reform farm worker immigration. But we've never secured enough votes to support the enactment of a law. And that's not just bad for our nation's economy. It's a national security risk. Our shortage of farm and food workers has forced us to rely on other countries to meet our food needs. In fact, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has projected that America, believe this or not, will soon become a net importer of agricultural products. When it comes to securing our nation's food supply chain, immigration reform is a top priority. And though strengthening our nation's borders is a crucial component, it's only one part of the equation. We need to approach this issue as an economic imperative, because the fact is immigration reform is the most immediate and meaningful step we could take today to resolve our shortage of workers. We need to recognize these issues are fundamentally interconnected. Many immigrants who cross the border end up working in the fields because of unmet demand for farm workers. Immigration reform would help reduce unauthorized immigration by legalizing this labor migration. But it seems that some, in states like Arkansas, would prefer to address the shortage by rolling back child labor laws. This is not a solution. This is a shame. Immigrants already account for more than 60% of all farm workers in our country. Most of them are undocumented. Let's put the facts on the table.
What's at stake?
What would happen to America's farm operations if we deported these workers? Well, let me tell you about a farmer named Shay Myers. Testified before our committee 2 years ago during our last hearing on the importance of immigrant farm workers. Shay shared with us that his asparagus farm lost an entire season's worth of profit because 36 H-2A workers were delayed at the border, and they couldn't find domestic workers to replace them. He noted, and I quote, "It's not safe because if we can't get workers, we can't harvest our crops. If we can't harvest our crops, we can't feed you." Shay is one of the millions of Americans, farmers, and business owners who understand our economy depends on the labor of immigrants. Reducing the wages of legal immigrant farm workers or forcing undocumented farm workers out of the workforce, as some have proposed, is not a solution. Instead, lawmakers must enact new laws to protect the rights of these workers while also providing them with a path to permanent legal status. These reforms will ensure that farm workers can continue contributing to our nation.
Adam Litch is operations manager at L&M Farms in North Central Florida, talking about what would happen if farmers and ranchers and agribusiness had to rely on E-Verify.
E-Verify alone, without some reforms to the H-2A program or a visa program, would certainly be devastating. I think both have to happen together. We live in and operate in states that currently do have E-Verify, and we comply with those laws. But I think for the ag sector overall, which is, I think, what you're asking, it would be pretty devastating to have that based on the percentage that you mentioned of workers that are undocumented. So both have to happen together. There has to be some type of H-2A reform, greater access to the program before mandatory E-Verify.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Listeners know I do spend a lot of time on meat demand, and it's because, you know, all the value for the industry starts with what consumers, whether it's foreign or domestically, are willing to spend on beef.
K-State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonser.
So before I lose this in the numbers, I always like to remind us there's basically this three-legged stool. So you've got foreign demand for U.S. meat. You've got the domestic demand through retail, primarily grocery stores for at-home consumption. And then you have domestic demand away from home, you know, think dinner meal at a restaurant kind of thing. So we have different measures for each of those channels. The export demand, the most recent numbers that I have based on USDA information, they were updated right before Memorial Day. They're good through March, so there's a time lag on that USDA trade info in particular. And foreign demand for U.S. beef has continued to slip. Year over year, we've had declines since July. Conversely, foreign demand for U.S. pork has improved since September. Now, in both cases, we're comparing to pretty high bases. So last summer, foreign demand for beef was very strong, while pork demand, foreign demand that is, was fairly weak. So those trends have reversed. But we don't have year-over-year strength on foreign beef demand, and that's worth noting here because we're relying on the domestic market pretty heavily, and that's where the Meat Demand Monitor comes in.
So why have we seen these changes in demand?
My main thesis on why we've had the decline on foreign demand for U.S. beef is a pause in macroeconomic activity, uncertainty in general around the world. It's kind of a mixed bag of who you ask if the next 12 months are going to be that way or not. Most think globally inflation has gotten better. So maybe we're towards the peak of interest rates. But if that's the case, then, you know, potentially we're hitting that peak on interest rates and some Federal Reserve parallels around the world might start loosening their monetary policy, which historically stimulates economic activity and then ultimately maybe some buying power. If the U.S. dollar weakens further compared to foreign currencies, that makes our beef cheaper on the global market. So that is possible as well. I'm sort of neutral. If you put a, you know, ask me, is it going to get better or worse? I think it'll probably get a little bit better, but I don't see it rallying a lot because there's still some macroeconomic gray clouds on the horizon.
So what's in the May demand monitor?
The Meat Demand Monitor is beef and pork checkoff funded, looks at the both domestic channels. First, the retail demand. Four of the eight categories that we track, and specifically here, ribeye steak, ground beef, pork chop, and bacon, which are the two beef and the two pork, were up in May compared to April. That's great. So think grocery store, away from home demand. All categories, so again, we track eight of them, six of the eight. So the two exceptions here would be plant-based patty and shrimp, were up in May of 23 compared to May of 22. So I usually share both month over month as well as year over year changes, and that's what I'm doing there. That is a very new statement. So for several months, I've been talking about year over year declines. And what that's getting at was domestic demand, by most of my estimates, peaked sometime in 2022. But fortunately, here in May of 23, the grocery channel, at least, retail channel we're tracking, six of the eight categories, including both beef and both pork, were higher in May of 23 than May of 22. It would be wonderful for the industry going forward if that continued. We'll see in a month what the numbers are, but that is a nice development.
So what about restaurant demand? What's Tonser seeing there?
Specifically, this is dinner meal. So again, there's multiple meals, and we hone in on the dinner meal. Four meals that we track had demand up in May versus April, and that included the beef hamburger meal, actually the plant-based patty, shrimp, and salmon. So notice the ones I excluded from that list. They would be ribeye steak as well as both pork that are tracked. Actually, were down in May compared to April. So if you back up for a moment and comment across the two domestic channels, it was a mixed bag. So there's more clear demand strength month over month basis here for beef and pork through the grocery store channel than there was through the food service channel in May.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
By this past Sunday, corn growers already had 96% of the U.S. crop in the ground, and by the time you hear this, they've probably got the remaining 4% planted and done.
That's absolutely right, because we have seen almost completely open Midwestern weather over the last several weeks.
USDA meteorologist Brad Ribby, the open weather sped up planting operations and emergence as well.
85% of the corn emerged by June 4th, far ahead of the five-year average of 77%.
But there's a negative to all this open Corn Belt weather.
We're starting to see that emerging dryness and drought chipping into the condition.
And chipping quite a bit off the condition ratings compared to a week ago.
Good to excellent ratings down this week to 64%. That's a whopping 5 percentage point decline from the previous week.
And there's one more percentage of corn rated poor to very poor at 6%. So as Brad cautiously puts it, we're seeing
signs of trouble starting to percolate.
Gary Crawford, Washington.